From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hurricane Katrina knocked down a city, but it has not erased the spirit of New Orleans. The music, the literature, the cuisine, the history, or the families who traced three, four, five generations in the Big Easy and live on, for the moment, in Baton Rouge, in Houston, in Arkansas, and across the country. This hour, their personal stories. We'll hear from author and historian Douglas Brinkley, who watched the storm ravage his city, who fled and came back with a boat to go house to house in search of survivors, in search of history. We'll hear from two musicians, Big Chief Monk Boudreau and Derek Oops Moss, who until last week helped keep the New Orleans party on its feet until the sun came up, and now want nothing more than to go back home and play some music. This hour On Point, voices from New Orleans on the stories, the past, the terrible present, and the unknown future of their beloved city. You can join the conversation. Did you flee New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina? What New Orleans moment from these last 2 weeks from a lifetime sticks in your mind? What haunts you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Houston, Texas, is Douglas Brinkley, distinguished professor of history and director of the Theodore Roosevelt Center for American Civilization at Tulane University. He stayed in New Orleans through the onset of the hurricane, then fled for Houston with his wife and children. He has returned to New Orleans and, in a boat, gone house to house to rescue survivors. He's at work on an essay on the hurricane and its aftermath for the Rolling Stone magazine. Douglas Brinkley, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We are trying to get past the giant lens of the national news story and down to the personal sense of what's happened here. Tell us about your last 10 days, Doug Brinkley.
Well, this is hurricane season along the Gulf states. I used to live in Bay St. Louis for about Mississippi for about 5 years. That whole town is now decimated. When this hurricane came around, I evacuated my house, boarded it up, and went to a high-rise building, vertical evacuation, if you'd like, mm-hmm. known as One River Place, to wait out the storm. It was built, One River Place, after the Camille hurricane of 69 and was supposed to be safe. It was fairly safe and didn't get too much damage, but the wind was blowing so hard, it sounded like a railroad train, coming right through your living room, that we retreated to the first floor of the building. There was a generator there. We kind of commiserated with other families that were there and stayed to weather the storm. At that point, I realized from the force of the wind just how strong it was. And I went back up through the stairwell to the top of the building after the storm left, and I saw the devastation and realized that it would be imperative to get out of town. So I got in my vehicle, load up family, some belongings, not much, and just zoomed out of New Orleans as quickly as I could, while the police officers were starting to wander the streets and scratch their heads and figure out what to do next. And I found out the one exit that where all the damage on I-10, Interstate 10 goes, of course, from Jacksonville, Florida to Santa Monica, California, and it cracked in a lot of places, but it was good from a town called Metairie outside of New Orleans all the way to Baton Rouge and Houston and beyond. So I got to that one exit, and once I got on 10, there was nobody else really on the road except some assistance help coming in the opposite direction, and off I went to Houston. Once I got my family in a safe living environment, a hotel, I then went back to New Orleans and it been working, trying to help people with the rescue mission there for a bunch of days, getting people out of buildings by boats. And I can tell you, when you hear people talk about toxic sludge and how New Orleans water is like poison soup, this is not hyperbole, it's not an exaggeration, it's that bad and worse.
Doug Brinkley, tell us about your family's links to New Orleans. I guess it comes through your wife's side.
Well, that's correct. My wife is from New Orleans. Well, she was born at Touro Hospital, and my two children were born at Touro, one of the hospitals that was forced to close, and they found bodies there and left behind, and it was also been terribly looted. It's our neighborhood hospital. Her whole family lives there, and it's a very large extended family. She's Jewish, and there's a large Jewish community in New Orleans that's been there for a while, and so it's kind of a kind of Jewish geography, they call in New Orleans, but they all the, this group of synagogues that, you know, we know the people at, and we were connected to them through the hurricane and our way out. I'm Catholic myself, and it's a completely, largely Catholic town, New Orleans, and I think right now some of the synagogues and the churches and Catholic Jewish ministries are doing extraordinary work in New Orleans trying to get food and medical attention to the needy.
We want to dig in very close, very intimately on what you've seen on the boat back in New Orleans, trying to help people get out, on your sense as an historian of what is at stake here. But you mentioned that it's worse than we've seen, and we've heard conflicting views, different characterizations of that, just in the last 24 hours. I want to listen to a couple of those and get your view, Douglas Brinkley. First Lady Laura Bush was in schools and evacuation centers along the Gulf Coast yesterday, and here she responded to a question about how the relief effort is going.
Across the board, very, very well. That's what I would say. I think we've seen a lot of the same footage over and over that isn't necessarily representative of what really happened.
The same footage over and over, it may not be as bad as all that. On the other hand, here's a Coast Guard pilot, happens to be from Massachusetts, John Nixon, and a swimmer, Matthew O'Dell, talking about what they're seeing in their rescue efforts in New Orleans.
It's worse than you think it is. It's far worse than what you see on your television set.
Yeah, you, either. To smell the water, you know, with the sewage in it, with the oil in it, gas burning, you know, buildings burning.
It's not so bad. It's worse than you think it is. You've been there very recently, Douglas Brinkley. You've been on the boat in the streets. Is it as bad as it looks? Is it better? Is it worse?
It's worse. And to paraphrase Laura Bush, it's very, very worse. You know, it's the you have to be removed. If you're not going to get into where the damage is, then you can say what you want. The relief effort, at best, is crawling forward. It is not working anywhere nearly as well as it should be. There's still thousands of people in desperate, desperate need this many days outside the crisis. And if you go in to where the pilots were, and they're trying to tell you when you get in there, you are stunned about how much worse it is. When we went out on these boats, you would go into a building, and you thought that this is buildings not far from the Superdome.
Yes.
We aren't talking about isolated, you know, community in coastal Louisiana or something. It's right where the heart of where the media and all the attention is, and there are people in buildings that can't get out, that they have no... They're begging when they see you, they're begging for bottles of water. They couldn't evacuate because of infirmities. Many of them are elderly and were left behind. Families thought the hurricane wouldn't be bad. We'll take the kids and we'll go and we'll leave grandma or grandpa back. Alzheimer's patients all abandoned. Senior citizens' homes abandoned. I was with a gentleman named Calvin Fayard, an attorney who went in and rescued over 20 nuns from a convent that had been forgotten the other day. These stories go on and on and on. And, you know, when you hear the estimates of the death, if it started being there's probably going to be 100 and then maybe 1,000. Mm. When the water clears, you're going to find a lot more dead people because everywhere you're going, even now, the water's up to, like, the stop signs covering whole shotgun houses. You know, many New Orleans homes are not three-story houses. They're just one-story shotguns and wood, and they're all in poor neighborhoods, and there's water over them all, and nobody has yet had... The first rule of a rescue operation would be that... I would say no door left behind, meaning we check every single house within the 100-mile storm damage radius. That's not being done.
Because there may still, even now, be people in there, trapped
not
there.
Not may. There are. They're there. They're there all over the place. And it's you get there and you see a presence. You'll find here are 10 policemen standing on a street corner. Here are 100 National Guard smoking a cigarette. They're not that they don't want to do something. Nobody's telling them what to do. And the lack of boats that were brought in into the flood region to do, you can't do aerial lifts to people trapped in houses. And when you do fly over, unless you get, can have, if you're young enough, you can get on a rooftop and start waving for
crawl
hours.
Out the window and get up to the shingles.
Yeah, but I'm talking about, I've held people out that had no legs.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that are it's completely infirmed. You know, the amount of elderly left behind, they were left behind as people people let their pets behind, and it's a sad, sad situation. And I don't think it helps by just being cheery about this. And I tend to be an American optimist and put a good face on everything. Yeah. But there's not a good face to put on how the rescue operations and have been organized and executed. It's been a bureaucratic nightmare.
The New York Times, one reporter described New Orleans as post-apocalypse, fires burn, dogs scavenge, half-baked, half-deluged, pestilent, eerie, and unnaturally quiet. It sounds very much like the picture you're bringing to us, Douglas Brinkley.
So the line you just read, whoever wrote that for the New York Times, I can tell you they were in New Orleans and spent time there, because that's exactly what you feel like. You stand around. When you get into the heart of the devastation, you feel as if a nuclear bomb went off, and it's an apocalyptic fear that kind of grips you, and you stand there. And when we were getting a boat out, some people out, we actually got so many on one of ours, and we took a little bit of water because we were piling people on. And then in front of us, we had to commandeer this boat through the muck and a building, a whole block just building on fire. And the next day, I never heard a word about this whole block being burned. I don't think the news media can capture all this, because there's so many horrific stories every second.
Doug Brinkley, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. Behind us, the New Orleans brass band, the Dirty Dozen, playing I Shall Not Be Moved, and yet the city is moved this week. We're talking about battered New Orleans, up close and personal, about this unique city and its people and its culture after catastrophe. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind me, the Dirty Dozen brass band from New Orleans, from their CD Funeral for a Friend. Just a little closer, Walk with Thee, and New Orleans could sure use that this week. We are talking in this hour about battered New Orleans, up close and personal, about this unique city and its people and its culture after catastrophe. We're talking with New Orleanians telling their stories of Katrina. We've been joined by Douglas Brinkley, a historian, longtime New Orleans resident, professor at Tulane University, author of Tour of Duty, John Kerry in the Vietnam War, The Boys of Point du Hoc, Ronald Reagan, D-Day, and the U.S. Army's 2nd Ranger Battalion. We'll be joined a little later by Big Chief Monk Boudreau, New Orleans musician, also Derek Oops Moss, another musician who we've spoken with before. You can join this conversation as well. Did you flee New Orleans and Katrina? What New Orleans moment from this last 2 weeks sticks in your mind, haunts you, and what are your distinctly New Orleans memories, New Orleans stories from good times or bad? And they are very bad right now. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Douglas Brinkley, Anne Rice wrote an essay recently, of course, the vampire novelist, among other enthusiasms, from New Orleans, very much from New Orleans, saying, what do people really know about New Orleans? What do they really know about what's at stake and what may be lost here? As you've floated through the streets in these days with your family tucked in Houston and looked at the ruins of this city, take us into your stream of consciousness about what's at stake, about what's gone before, about what's buried under these waters.
Well, I mean, I always think of democracy when I think of New Orleans, because it's the birthplace of jazz. And sadly, it's a city that often gets maligned from outside forces. By that I mean when the I-10, the interstate, was built, Storyville, the birthplace of jazz, got ripped down. So all those great buildings, historic buildings, because they were part of the African-American community, were neglected. I think race and racism is unfortunately a big part of New Orleans history, both in a positive and negative way. The Plessy case, which gave us Plessy versus Ferguson in the late 1890s, was about a streetcar or a train operator not allowing African-American on, and it triggered the separate but equal law, which had to be eventually overturned by Brown versus Topeka. On the other hand, it's the place, New Orleans, where Dr. King created the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, not Atlanta like most people think. It's a place where the literary history is so rich. Walt Whitman came down the Mississippi to New Orleans to write and get his ideas for Leaves of Grass. He used to write for the newspaper down there, and he later said that it was that the freed feeling of New Orleans as a port city. At that point, he encountered soldiers from the Mexican-American War and people, you know, mulattoes and Creoles and this whole kind of swirl of humanity that port cities often give you, and it inspired him so greatly. And writers like William Faulkner lived in New Orleans, and Sherwood Anderson, and F. Scott Fitzgerald, and William Burroughs, and you can just go on and name lists of them. And then in music, it's, you know, just the greats, you know, from Louis Armstrong to to Wynton Marsalis today, and everybody in between. And so it's Truman Capote, Tennessee Williams. It's such a rich American cultural center that, in fact, sometimes it seems to be our great cultural hub. I think New York and San Francisco, Chicago are these great American cities, but there's something so special about New Orleans due to its rich French and Spanish and then American history, and the fact that the Mississippi River flows right there, and it's at the end of America. You know, and when Jefferson bought New Orleans, President Jefferson, with the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, he did not try to buy the Louisiana Territory to double the size of the country. He wanted one thing, control of the port city of New Orleans, because he knew that it was such a strategically important location for us. It was the gateway to the Mississippi River, and it remains that today. And it's created its own distinct culture by mixing European culture with Caribbean and African culture, and they all kind of, and they get something new, and you get all kinds of foodstuffs that people all over the world talk about. And so it has something for it's not just a local localism, but it's a great international ambassador for the United States. You say the word New Orleans anywhere in the world, and you see a smile come on people's face.
There's a kind of, you mentioned jazz right off the bat, and there's this association with the freedom of jazz that I think everybody feels. I remember as a child, my parents would throw us all in the back of the station wagon when we follow the Mississippi down to New Orleans in the spring, and by the time we woke up there, it would be warm, and that beignet at morning call, and by that night dancing at Preservation Hall with my little sister, and the sense, even as a child, that this is a very free place. Things are flowing here. Can that survive, Douglas Brinkley?
It will survive, and the freedom is why I live there. I can live a lot of places. What I like is the soul of New Orleans isn't in brick and mortar. It's in the people. And New Orleanians, even those in the diaspora right now, the 400,000 plus that have had to leave, they left their city, but they didn't leave New Orleans. It's still in their soul. And those people, a lot of them will come back, and the people that have, they'll become a new New Orleans. And I hope that the magic of the place doesn't go away. I can't imagine that it will. Remember, it's seen a lot of bad days. When I wrote a book on that for National Geographic, with the late Stephen Ambrose, on the history of the Mississippi River. And when you do research on New Orleans, you start realizing that, you know, it was just always devastated by floods and also yellow fever epidemics. There's one church called St. Jude's on right near Storyville on Rampart, which was the only church that would take in the victims of yellow fever, and the whole city seemed wiped out by it. New Orleans has been through peril before, and it's rebounded. And I have no doubt that the city will come back. I just hope that it doesn't lose some of its charms in the mom-and-pop stores, because, you know, the Hiltons and the Sheridans and the Convention Center and the Superdome and, you know, those things are going to, you know, tourist meccas are going to continue to exist. I'm just hoping those little corner groceries where they serve the pull boys and muffalatas and you know, the you know, local hardware stores and the small businesses. What New Orleans offered America in recent years was a reprieve from dysfunction junctions and fast food strips, and sometimes you could be in Albuquerque and it looks the same as Los Angeles, which looks the same as Las Vegas.
But not New Orleans.
Not New Orleans. You always knew when you were there, and it had a smell in the air, mixture of petroleum, humidity, and like in a flower fragrance or something. But it's
a smell in the air right now. Douglas Brinkley, we've heard a lot about the horrors of the streets there. Corpses just tagged and left to float or lie until someone picks them up sometime. As you've gone through those streets by boat, describe your emotional reaction to us. Do you find yourself raging, weeping, just stunned?
I got into an adrenaline run because you start going in there and you see people, but you turn your head, you look at these corpses floating next to you, and you just don't know what to do. I have an image of one of the corpses was a guy who had a flashlight in his back pocket, and somehow, and he was seemed to have looked like he was trying to get out of his house or fix something, and I think he must have been knocked over the head and died, but it was just the image of his body. And you know, you hear all bodies get bloated from the water and floating there, and you never thought you'd be a point in your life in America that you'd be in a city street, not in a lake, but in a street you used to go down, going past bodies and not being able to do anything. The rule is don't touch the dead. We're trying to save the living, and then you just the decomposition of the bodies and the smell. Mixed sometimes where I was at with those cemeteries above, of course, were built above ground due to flooding. Some of them have broken loose, so you've got recent dead bodies that have been buried coming out mixed with the new dead, and it creates just a terrifying scene. And the Bush administration is asking that no photos be taken of these bodies, as if we're too immature of nation to be seen truth.
We've heard that FEMA announcing that it didn't want the news media taking photographs of the dead in New Orleans. It would offend the dignity of the dead.
I think that's just absurd, completely and utterly absurd, and I hope every photojournalist that's down there documents this for history, what occurred. We're not here to try to erase and sanitize what happened. We need to know, just as you did in a Holocaust, when Dwight Eisenhower was in Europe, he brought film crews and said, I want to film everything that took place in the concentration camps. So the Germans, generations from now, don't try to say it didn't happen. It wasn't that way. And Ike made them film everything. And when you see documentaries on the Holocaust, often the footage comes through directly from an Eisenhower directive. If Eisenhower were alive today, or George Marshall and the great generals of the World War II generation, they would want it documented. If you're a photographer down there, take pictures of the dead, and just totally disregard FEMA, which is an ineffective, bureaucratic organization that should, every person in top leadership there should be fired for the horrible job they've done in this crisis. It's nothing less than criminal.
Don't touch the dead until the living are safe, but don't look away either. This is an American city in trouble. Let's take a call. Anne-Marie's calling from Ellicott City, Maryland. Hi, Anne-Marie, you're on the air.
Hello. Firstly, let me say my father was raised in New Orleans. He lives in Alabama now. My grandmother's house, she passed away last year, is probably now underwater. I want to know, how are we going to fix it? If we rebuild New Orleans like it was, we're still below sea level, and this horrible, horrible catastrophe could happen again. How do we fix that?
Well, that's an important question, and I would simply say that it's a good time to read about the history of the Netherlands, one of the richest countries in the world, and look at a city like Amsterdam or Leiden or Den Haag or Rotterdam. They built their cities around canals and on dikes through engineering. It could be done in New Orleans. Look at Venice, which over the centuries has had a hard time, but it's one of the great cities of Europe, and you're virtually living in the water in a situation. New Orleans can, with proper engineering, proper federal assistance, build a levee system along Lake Pontchartrain that can absorb a not just a Hurricane 5, but if there was such a thing, a Hurricane 6 or 7, instead of a 3.
And now we're talking about $100 billion that presumably that the federal government may end up spending. It presumably would have been a lot less than that before this storm. I want to bring, if I may, and Anne-Marie, thanks for your call. I want to bring in another voice here. We're joined from Mesquite, Texas, where he is staying with his daughter, having fled Katrina, by Big Chief Monk Boudreau. He's part of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Indian tradition. He sings and plays the tambourine as Big Chief in the Golden Eagles tribe, which performs Afro-Caribbean funk. He was in New Orleans during the hurricane. He joins us this morning from Mesquite. Big Chief Monk Boudreau, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
How are you feeling?
I'm fine.
What do you think about your city? Is it going to survive?
Oh, yeah, sure. We'd have been bumped around before. This was just a little worse.
I understand that one of the things you're most worried about goes to the heart of this culture that you sustain and represent, the Mardi Gras parades and the Golden Eagle tribe. You, and I'm looking here at an album cover where you've got on your full costume, a kind of, it looks to me like Indian, Aztec, I don't know how to describe it, a very elaborate costume. That costume is back in New Orleans, and you're worried about it.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it takes so long to put it together. And they have, you know, like I have beaded patches on my suit, you know, it's over 50 years old.
Do you expect to wear that suit and play in New Orleans again, Monk Boudreau?
I surely do.
What gives you that confidence? You see how devastated the city is. We've all seen the images. You had to flee from it.
Yeah, but the way we built the suits, you could take them down and take the patches off, which, you know, all you have to do is just clean them up, you know, with Lysol and whatnot, and they'll hold up. I mean, because they'll wear hand sewn.
And what about the city itself? If you've got your back, you get the suit, you clean it up, but is the city going to be there to play in?
Oh, yeah, sure. The city been there for many years, and it'll still be there. All we have to do is tell us when to come home, and we're going to come home and do what we have to do.
We hope that your instruments and your costume are there, but you may have lost everything. How do you deal with that?
Well, you just have to get more, you know.
Just have to start again.
That's material things, you know.
Mm-hmm. Just material things. Do you think it'll change the music of New Orleans? Will there be a new stripe of blues woven into the New Orleans fabric after Katrina?
Well, I think a lot of the musicians will do songs on what's happening, you know, because I know I have a good head for it, and I know it's in there, and it's got to come out.
It must be welling up right now. Let's take another call. Susan's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I grew up in Mobile, Alabama, and spent a lot of time as a child in New Orleans, and therefore have some sense of the depths of what was lost in terms of the culture, the history, the music, the smells, the mom-and-pop stores, everything that Douglas Brinkley was referencing. And I'm just wondering if you and your guests think that the political machine is strong enough to spin this sufficiently so that people who haven't had the opportunity to experience the real New Orleans will understand what was lost.
What political machine, Susan, exactly are you thinking of?
Well, I guess I was enraged, to be perfectly honest, to hear Laura Bush's comments. I haven't heard people, for example, the people that are in charge of FEMA, George Bush even seriously talk about the people of New Orleans, the culture of New Orleans, and all of that commentary about the sadness of what was lost and the richness of what New Orleans used to be has come from people who have been down there and involved in the relief efforts. And I haven't heard that sort of depth of emotion come from the people who were in charge of the relief efforts.
Susan, we've got it, and we appreciate your call. Monk Boudreau, you've been watching, like the rest of us, how Washington has responded to your city's travail. What do you think of it? Are you satisfied, or are you worried that they'll turn the other way and forget it?
No, I don't think they will. I mean, because there's too much talk going on. I mean, they have to do what they have to do. And they do it all over the world. Why not New Orleans? Because that's our home. That's where we were born and raised. That's where our father before us helped to build that city. And so I think they're going to really do what they have to do, because the people is out here. They're everywhere. They're away from home, and they're just waiting to get back home.
And home is not yet waiting for them. Big Chief Monk Boudreau with the Golden Eagles tribe, Caribbean Afro-Funk out of New Orleans. We wish you well there in Mesquite, Texas with your daughter. We hope you're back in New Orleans soon and playing up a storm, and we're grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Monk Boudreau in Mesquite, Texas. Douglas Brinkley, please stick with us. We are talking this hour with New Orleanians, telling the stories of Katrina. You can join us. Have you gone back like Douglas Brinkley? Have you heard from relatives? What are you hearing? What are you hoping? What are you thinking about New Orleans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Jesus on the Main Line here from the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans.
Fats Domino of New Orleans singing Walking to New Orleans there. He, among many others, was lost for a while. Then he was found. We're talking in this hour about battered New Orleans, up close and personal, about this unique city and its people and its culture. After catastrophe, you can join the conversation. What New Orleans moment from this last 2 weeks sticks in your mind, haunts you? Will we hang on to the soul of New Orleans? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined throughout this hour from Houston, Texas, by Douglas Brinkley, historian at Tulane University. He's been going back and forth, rescuing people in boats. A lot of callers want to join this conversation as well. John is calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And yeah, I lived in New Orleans for 2.5 years, and I worked down there as a musician and lived in the city, lived in the French Quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And what struck me was that I would see every weekend a big function, a giant function, and the news would report that the city had taken in $157 million that weekend.
From the latest convention or influx of tourists.
Yeah, exactly. And I heard that constantly, and I could look around, and I couldn't figure out where any of the money was going. Because I could look at the infrastructure of the city. You could walk in the city buildings and see them falling apart and decay. And like I said, I saw millions and millions of dollars going into the city itself. And I can't figure out why any of it wasn't used to solve some of the problems that they have.
A lot of poverty sitting right around those millions. It's a great question, John. Thanks for calling it. Douglas Brinkley, what do you say to that? The whole world has been kind of slack-jawed at the poverty that emerged right along the Gulf and by no means least in New Orleans. It brought in a mint. What happened to the money? Why so much poverty?
Well, look, I mean, ever since the Reconstruction period in the South, particularly, it's been difficult for African Americans. It's been over 100 years of slavery, and you had the Great Migration northward to cities like Detroit and the like. But there's been for the African American community in the South, from slavery to freedom, has not brought the kind of economic and educational prosperity that one would hope for. And so there's a large degree of poverty, and it's nothing new. When you look at photos of the Great Depression, you're stunned by the abject poverty that's in a lot of the Deep South, and particularly in the African-American community.
But does rebuilding New Orleans mean rebuilding that poverty, just going back to that?
No. And
why not?
Well, because we've got to be smarter about it, and I think we're now in the rescuing of New Orleans, both its people and actually the structures themselves. Once that phase is done, we're going to have a rebuilding, and we have to think about how to do it. And I think our caller's correct in the sense that I wasn't born in New Orleans, but it's my adopted home. And the amount of graft and political corruption, and you only get things done about who you know, the old boy, network,
yeah,
in Louisiana, it's kind of colorful. It lends itself to All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren and,
sure,
other great bits of fiction about political demagoguery and corruption. But beyond that kind of intriguing literary value, it hurts people, and it's stealing, and it's done on a widespread basis. And a lot of it, is because of the ragged ports. Things can come in and out of New Orleans with less notice than most places. So drug trafficking or sneaking in of exotic pets and money paid under the table. Police force in New Orleans, sorely underpaid. I mean, you're talking about people that can't even make $20,000 a year being a police officer.
And really falling apart in this last week at its margins anyway.
Because of it, and many of them quit. You know, is it worth it for $18,000 a year to be working no sleep and working around the clock? And so the problems are very, very large, and they're going to have to be addressed. One doesn't ever again in America want to build these kind of housing projects where you do a vertical building of pouring all people with low means into one building and not giving them resources. And the housing projects in America from the 60s and 70s are a failure. It's something Habitat for Humanity, for example, a private organization, nonprofit, has been saying now for since the 80s.
So rebuild it differently, and everybody will be watching that. We've got another voice I really want to bring in, Doug Brinkley, if I may, from Savannah, Georgia, today, but lifelong from New Orleans. We're joined by Derek Oops Moss. He's bass drummer, founding member of the Soul Rebels, a group the Village Voice has described as the missing link between Louis Armstrong and Public Enemy. Spent most of his life in New Orleans. He's been a guest with us on Point just about a year ago. Derek Moss, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
How did you get out of New Orleans?
I jumped in my truck, which really wasn't prepared for a trip like this, and I just started driving. I had to get my sister and my niece and a friend of hers and get them out of there. I was in Jackson, Mississippi by friends of hers for 3 days. Then I moved to Prentice, Mississippi, where my grandfather has a country house. And I helped them until they got power and water and food and gas. And then I moved to Starkville, Mississippi, where my kids were. But their mother moved somewhere south and was going headed to Texas. So
yep.
Now I'm in South Carolina with Rob Benson, who's the president of my record label.
And let me, Derek Moss, you've told us that you are glad to be as far from New Orleans and that mass of evacuees as possible right now. Why? Is it just too much? Were you overwhelmed?
Well, yes. Yeah. Well, I wasn't overwhelmed. I'm a realist, so I deal with reality. I'm not a person that'll freak out over anything. I always keep my head and make decisions and then act on it. But a lot of people are kind of like crazy, and they just lose their minds and make it hard on everyone. So I just wanted everybody I knew, friends and relatives, to just get out. It doesn't make sense to take a chance with your life on a Category 5 hurricane that's right off the coast. You know, you can't win if it hits you directly, so why take a chance on staying?
And what about that chaotic aftermath? We know people were hungry and thirsty and felt abandoned, and we saw a tremendous amount, it seems, of lawlessness in the streets of New Orleans. How do you explain that, Derek Moss?
Actually, I could start by saying that I was born in New Orleans in Charity Hospital, and I lived all my life there. So I know about all of the stuff, the inside politics and all, and everything that you guys said right before I came on is absolutely true. This guy is really on the mark, and it is. The politics are corrupt, the police corrupt, but you can't get quality people because they don't pay them enough. The school board was stealing all of the money, so the kids were losing out. Then you have kids that's being passed to the next grade who doesn't know anything, and then eventually they graduate, and just for the hell of it, you know, and that's how that poverty cycle starts. And a lot of them are on welfare, food stamps and all, and there's really nowhere for them to go up. So they just stay there. And generation after generation goes through the same cycle. Then that's how you get so many people condensed into that one area that basically have no skills and nowhere to go.
And felt abandoned, and some got pretty rowdy last week. Let me ask you about the conversation the whole world has watched between New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin, essentially, and President Bush,
yeah.
With Ray Nagin very outspoken, very angry. How do you end up feeling about your mayor?
He got my vote. I will vote for him for reelection because it had to be done. I was so proud of him. It had to be done, and that was the first time I ever heard any politician go off like that, and he did apologize if he offended anyone and the president, and then he turned right back around and said, so what are you going to do for us? You know, And it was crazy. And I have to tell you all that I was in the Air Force Reserve for 6 years, so I know both sides, the civilian and military life. And me knowing what I know about our military capabilities, that was a total disgrace. And the country should be ashamed of showing that we cannot help our own when we can be right there in within hours to help other people, but it take 3 or 4 or 5 days to help your own.
There it is, straight from a voice from New Orleans. Derek Moss, Douglas Brinkley, stand by. Joan's calling from Winchester, Virginia. Hi, Joan, you're on the air.
Well, hello, and thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you. What are you thinking?
Well, I feel a lot of sadness and a lot of anger. I was born and raised in New Orleans, and my family goes back there for generations. And I was there at the time of Betsy. And after Betsy in 65 or 66, I mean Camille, which we know about the history there, but after Betsy, I know that there was talk of the levees being shored up then. And I've been out of New Orleans, which is a city I love, but so many of the folks that you've had speaking on air just recently who've had experiences from
yeah,
New Orleans
yeah.
have hit the mark. I mean, Mr. Brinkley, who has done some history on the city. I mean, I've done my own research with the Jazz Archives from Tulane University. Excellent, fabulous. The sadness that I experience and I'm feeling now is that nothing was done sooner. And I couldn't fathom the damage now. But another part of the sadness is looking at the city that I know and love, can't live there because wages seem to be so low. The corruption is pervasive throughout the government and has been for a long time.
So will it go on? Will it come back? It's in an awful bad way right now.
I have faith in it. And the people are so... The people who are New Orleanians and who have stayed there, they know what the city has. They know... You can take the person out of New Orleans, but you cannot take New Orleans out of the person.
We can hear that in the emotion you bring to us right here this morning, Joan. Thanks very much for calling. Let's get another caller here. Richard is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Richard, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much. Wanted to say first that I've been to New Orleans many times, and it's one of the finest cities around. The music, the way everything mingles and flows together there, it's a real city from the heart. But when I was 15, I spent the night of Camille on the other side of a levee across, right at Lake Pontchartrain, just across the road from the levee.
Yeah.
And I remember all the talk then, nationally and locally, was if a hurricane ever comes through and breaks the levee system or comes through and pushes Lake Pontchartrain over to New Orleans, it's going to be one of the worst disasters in the world. Mm-hmm. And to hear George Bush come on the air and say, well, nobody expected this, and then to have the FEMA respond the way that it did, you know, show up 2 days later, it's fine. I mean, somebody in the press is the only people out there I know that can do it, needs to hold these people accountable. Because since at least 69, as a 15-year-old, I've been telling people since then, I'm 51 now, and so for whatever many years that is, I've been telling people.
That's a long time.
If a hurricane ever comes to New Orleans, it's going to blow the place up.
Well,
it's just ridiculous, and it's shameful that President Bush, a man who claims to be a Christian, would come on the air and tell a lie like that and do what he's done.
Richard, we've got it, and we understand the perspective. Derek Moss, let me ask you, in addition to playing with the Soul Rebels, and it's quite the playing, you're also a supervisor in the Sewage and Water Board. Can you see how this is going to be rebuilt, how it's going to be pulled back together?
Well, what I do in my day job is I inspect contractors that's laying main sewer, water, and drainage systems, which is civil engineering in the city. And I probably won't be able to work again for some months or so, I don't know, because we can't do anything underground until all of the water is clear and we're able to dig under and repair some pipes or do some cleaning, rechlorination of the system that we have in place.
This is going to be a long time, but it sounds like job one, when you talk about drainage right now, once you get down to your level, it sounds like your job will certainly be there. Let's get another call. David's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am feeling very saddened that I've always wanted to visit New Orleans and now feel I may not get the chance, or at least to visit it as most people experienced it. But I know there's been talk about some of this over the last few days, but I wonder beyond sort of the emotional ties there, what's the wisdom of rebuilding the city that seems only likely to get wipped out again? And as I understand, the protective barrier land is continues to erode, and we're in a bad cycle. And
it's still going to be sitting in that soup bowl. Let us pick it up, Douglas Brinkley. That question gets raised, even as people bemoan that the hit New Orleans has taken. How do you respond to that?
Well, again, I will retell you that there are many of the world's great cities, which New Orleans clearly is, like Amsterdam and Venice are two examples I gave that are built around water. New Orleans is never going to go away. It's as important of American city as imaginable, and a great country doesn't abandon its culture. And New Orleans is so much part of the fabric of this nation that it's going to continue to grow and to thrive. And so we've got to put protections, and we are a highly industrial society that spends billions of dollars all over the world rebuilding things, and we're going to have to rebuild those levee system along Lake Pontchartrain. We're going to have to restore the coastal barrier islands. We're losing every week about a mile of wetlands. It's not a joke. Wetland, it's the same in Florida with the Everglades. Wetlands are part of an ecosystem that must be maintained, and we're going to have to do what people have been petitioning and pleading to do, and that's rebuild the barrier islands up and start a Louisiana coastal wetlands restoration project.
It's a big job. Let me ask you, you've been in the Astrodome in Houston also, attending, following up with New Orleanians there. Do you feel that resolve, or are people just flat on their back?
Mixed. I'd say half the people that I talk to are ready to not come back to New Orleans right now. They're looking to start their lives either in Houston or San Antonio or L.A., or they're going somewhere where some relative is. Other half are just waiting for the word go, and they're ready to come back to New Orleans. But I'll have to tell you one thing the media has missed is I've met, let's just say a ballpark figure of about 1,000 New Orleanians who haven't left that the media doesn't show, that are working on rescue operations, that are doing neighborhood patrols against vandalism and looting right now, that are every day going out and saving people. There's already a core band of people reclaiming their city, New Orleanians for them,
shirt sleeves rolled up and maybe pant legs rolled up as well. Derek Moss, we just got half a minute here. When do you think you'll be back on stage with the Soul Rebels, rolling it out in New Orleans?
I have no idea, but I'm willing to meet the band and get on with some things. We want to do something that can help the situation. First of all of our equipment and instruments are left in New Orleans, so all of our stuff is gone. If we could find a way to help get some instruments to start it up and go do some touring and help make some people feel good, that's what we do.
Piece by piece. Derek Oops Moss, bass drummer with the Soul Rebels, thanks for being with us. It's been great getting your view. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, you're doing a great job.
Well, we appreciate you joining us out there on the road, far from home right now. And Douglas Brinkley, shuffling back and forth between Houston, Texas, and a boat on the streets of New Orleans, historian at Tulane University. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We'll go out once more with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, the sound of New Orleans, here playing Amazing Grace. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.